We will start by actually going back a little bit to finish the discussion of performance as a function of stencil size, because you might remember that I found that I was missing a few foils in that discussion. So we discussed last time this graph here, which shows the communication to calculation ratio with a simple 5-point and then a 9-point and also another 9-point stencil, and showed a slight tendency as the stencil size increased to improve the performance of the system. And we measured the improvement by the coefficient of this parameter t-com over t-calc, which starts off as 1 over root n for the simplest case, Jacobi, and went to 0.5 over root n for this full stencil shown here. So what this foil here points out is it just repeats essentially the analysis we did in class, but it does it for a stencil of increasing size. So here's the Jacobi one, which where we know that the coefficient of t-com over t-calc is 1 over root n. And then this is the one we did at the bottom of the last foil, 1 over 2 root n. Now you could imagine just increasing the stencil by one more unit. So the update of that point just depended on contributions from all points in rows or columns which are a distance 2 away. If you do that analysis, you will find that it's 1 over 3 root n. And if you go far away, it's 1 over 4 root n. And you can easily guess what happens as you increase the size of the stencil. So if you actually go to a stencil that covers the whole domain, which is actually a very natural stencil, because it's what you get with any long-range force calculation. So when you have the update of one point depending on all other points in the domain, that's a stencil which essentially is the stencil where all points are involved. So that's actually physically what happens when you do an n-body problem. You will find that ingeniously this number here gets bigger and bigger, and then with some sort of phase transition it actually becomes 1 over n, not some coefficient over root n. And n is this grain size, the number of points stored per processor. So this analysis demonstrates this rather interesting effect that as you increase the complexity of the computation, it actually increases in efficiency, which is sort of slightly counterintuitive. And it shows for all these examples that Jacobi is the hardest, and n-body is the easiest, which is a well-known fact. And the reason is the reason we described in the last lecture, namely, as you increase the size of the stencil, if you think about it in the wrong way, you say, well, for every update we have to communicate more points, but the way to think about it is for every point communicated it gets used more often, because I actually will include a given processor might have all these points, so when I transmit any one of these points it will get used in several times in updating the points within the processor. And so that means that every communication I use that point many times, and therefore the efficiency is actually higher. But the reason Jacobi is a low efficiency is that although I don't communicate very much, so it looks as though it's high efficiency, I only use each point once. As you increase the size of the sensor, you use each point many times because of the increasing complexity of the computation. So that's the general reason why as problems get more complex, they get more efficient. Because what counts is, this is a sort of fundamental principle of computing, is why caches work. Caches work because you reuse data. These parallel machines get more efficient because you can reuse the communicated data more often. And so it turns out the harder the problem, the lower the overhead, is the general rule. Because if you have a messy problem with all sorts of complex matrices and it's nonlinear, that tends to mean you reuse data more substantially more often and do more floating point operations per communicated point. So these are this file here is actually a very old file. It comes from probably 1985. It's actually done by Steve Otto at Caltech, my student there. And the nice thing about, the reason I like this point is it actually, this graph, it actually plots this overhead, F sub C, which is 1 over the efficiency minus 1. And it shows, and it plots it against 1 over root n. And if you remember, the formula says that the overhead depends linear as a coefficient times 1 over root n. And then we get these straight lines, which only where we get the smallest slope for a certain class of decompositions, these ones shown here, which happen to be the best decompositions. But for a given decomposition, the main point is that it is rigorously true that as I change the value of root n, the grain size, you do get this nice linear behavior, except for a small tailing off at a large 1 over root n, which is very small n. And so this predicted form, and this has been the predicted form, which as you see is in excellent agreement with the measurements. So this type of analysis is a relatively precise analysis. This is another very old graph, which I happened to find when I was looking for this other foil on varying template size. This happens to be from a physics simulation, quantum chromodynamics. So I'll start again, as I didn't click that thing. So this comes from, this is an old foil from which you'll find, which comes from probably about 7 years ago, from a quantum chromodynamics computation. And it plots efficiency here, not the overhead. So actually there's efficiency. When you plot efficiency, you don't get straight lines, because its efficiency has not got any special dependence. But the one thing you would get is, I pointed out this issue of scaled speed up. Now, when you fix the grain size and vary the number of nodes, you should get a universal overhead and a universal efficiency. And so that's shown here, that if you just fix the grain size, which in this case here is a total of 8 cubed, this is a four-dimensional problem, so there's 8 cubed by 16 grid points in every processor node, you do get a fixed communication overhead of 14% and correspondingly an efficiency of 86%. And so these measurements show the scale speed-up effect, that you get a linear dependence of speed-up or a constant efficiency if you fix the grain size. However, if you fix the problem, which you see here, then if we're in a fixed problem, then the grain size decreases as you increase the machine size. So as we go up here to 128 nodes, the largest machine, it has a lower efficiency than a smaller number of machines. So fixed problem, the efficiency decreases. Fixed grain size, the efficiency is constant. And of course, as I decrease the grain size, I decrease the efficiency for a given number of nodes, because we know that the efficiency always goes up as the grain size increases, because efficiency is to do with edge over area, and the higher the efficiency, the higher the grain size, the smaller the overheads, the edge over area effect. And so this is again a most problems show this. This particular problem has got the standard local physical structure, just happens to be in four dimensions, not three dimensions. Okay. So that's all I wanted to show on the okay, so the next section of this class, we're meant to just briefly review the various architectures of high performance, let's be precise, high performance computers. And so we'll discuss, of course, very quickly sequential and computers, vector supercomputers, and then the various classes of parallel computers, which tend to be classified by this classification introduced by Flynn, which only has two interesting categories, MIMD and SIMD, as far as parallel machines is concerned. Not much to say about von Neumann machines. They're almost by definition extremely simple. You have essentially a single memory, you have a single CPU, the CPU can have multiple functional units, and then you make use of caches to increase performance. And obviously there's you can read these nifty books like those by Hennessy and Patterson to find out in detail how to build a wonderful microprocessor as that CPU. But this course will basically not discuss that. I found this foil here, which for the purposes of the real audio, we notice we'll have to cut the audio here. This is foil 24. No, it's not, sorry. So this illustrates the importance of the cache. This just measures the speed of a conventional sequential computer, a high-end RS 6000. And this is the measured performance on a simple inner product, the vector dot product of x dot y, of two vectors, and here's the vector length. And then for very small vectors, you have a performance of around 50 megaflops, and then for large vectors of length around 10,000, it goes down to about 28 megaflops. And the reason for that is that on a problem like this, and in fact most sequential machines, you end up being dominated by memory access, and the purpose of the cache is to ensure that the data is, if possible, sitting in very fast memory next to the CPU. If you have a very large vector, it will not fit into the cache, and therefore it should get so the performance will decrease, because the observed performance is not actually measuring the performance of the CPU, but the resultant effect of having both a CPU and the memory accesses. So this degradation of almost a factor of 2 says that half the time is spent refilling the cache, or equivalently accessing memory. And actually accessing, the reason I just put this foil here, in some sense designing a computer is dominated by accessing memory, because that's what really that's what's actually a hard part about designing a computer, is trying to get the data next to the CPU. We talked about this when we discussed the performance of that Laplace example. What do? We try to transfer the data from one processor to the processor that needed it. So we needed to get it near to the CPU. So that's effectively the user doing the same thing as a cache does automatically on a sequential machine. A cache automatically moves data from main memory to very fast memory next to the machine, and then registers make it even faster and make it even closer to the CPU. What you're doing on a distributed memory machine, like we analyzed from the Laplace's equation, is effectively doing what's done in a cache, but doing it by hand. And you're doing it because there's even greater penalty on a shared on a parallel distributed memory machine for accessing the memory when it's stored in a different processor and you have to send messages to get it. So if you like, what's usually called data locality is the key concept in all high-performance computers. The key to getting good performance is to get these very fast CPUs and arrange your software and your algorithms so that the information they need to do their computation is sitting as near as possible to the CPU. Preferably in registers, not registers cache. If not in cache, one of the caches, the main memory of the CPU attached to that main memory bank. If it's not there, then at least have it in a memory of another node in the parallel machine. And worst of all, have it on a disk, which is then paging. I mean, we would get even worse performance if we had such a large vector that the system had to page and send the information out the disk. So memory access is effectively the dominant issue. It's not usually phrased in that fashion. Vector supercomputers are effectively typified by the machines from Cray, the older machines from CDC and its spin-off ETA, and by the Japanese vendors. Vector supercomputers are one particular approach to addressing, if you like, this memory bandwidth problem or memory access problem, which is really a latency problem, by optimizing the memory access and the performance for vector operations, such as C of I equals A of I plus B of I. And they really are trying to address two problems, one of which we've already illustrated in some sense for that IBM product, which is really just got a multiplication here instead of a plus, and it sums over the C sub I, which is that that it takes a certain amount of time to access memory, which time a single memory access, the machine can do very many floating point operations. An IBM RS6000, I think, can do 3 floating point operations per clock cycle. It's either 2 or 3. I think it's 3. The other point is that any The more complex floating point operations tend to take several clock cycles to complete. Then you, if you have a processor running at 100 megahertz, it does not complete a single floating point operation in 10 to the minus 8 seconds, namely in one clock cycle. It will usually take a few clock cycles to complete. What it can do is start a new floating point operation every clock cycle. So this graph here, is meant to sort of illustrate how a vector machine works. Namely, you take a vector and you stream the data from main memory into vector registers, which are you can think of as caches or just registers. They're just very fast memory which can store sequentially data to be processed. And here we've this is actually an error on the foil. It should say here Mantissa. I mean, when we're adding two floating point numbers, we've got to look at the exponents, shift one of the Mantissas, and then add the Mantissa. So this should say Mantissa shift here. Then we add them, and then we normalize the result to make it a legal floating point number. So there are four stages here, which may or may not be one clock cycle, but on a typical machine, a floating point operation takes a few clock cycles. And as I say, we can have one floating point operation entering here every clock cycle, and therefore we can get one result every clock cycle. So essentially, vector supercomputers are just implementing a pipeline, noting that many scientific operations have the property that they apply the same function to a set of to vectors. So that's Cray's good idea, which he implemented first in the Cray 1 back in 1976, I guess. So all right, so what's good and bad about this? Well, it certainly works. I would say that there are at least two reasons why it's not so popular as in the past. Namely, in the good old days, it used to take an awful lot of steps to do a floating point operation. I mean, a good example was this Intel 8087, which we used on the first hypercube we built at Caltech. This was the first floating point chip. I think it's the first serious microprocessor floating point chip. And so the Cosmic Cube, which was a 64 nodes, each of which was an 8086 and an 8087, the first really good microprocessors. It could do somewhere between a floating point operation took somewhere between between 20 and 50 microseconds, even though the clock speed was 8 megahertz. So that said that it took some 160 to 400 clock cycles to complete a single floating point operation. So that said, the 8087 took a lot, the way it was implemented, it took a lot of clock cycles to do a single floating point operation. But it only had, I don't know, 50,000, at most 50,000 transistors in it. So what's happened is that when you have today's microprocessors with, I don't know, 5 million transistors in them, you can build a far cleverer floating point. Well, I mean, if you have more transistors, you can do more things per clock cycle. And so you can complete your floating point operation not in 100 or 200 clock cycles, you can complete it in 4 or 5 clock cycles. And so the need to pipeline to And therefore send leaves. You see, the Cray was designed around the concept that you had to have 100 floating point operations to get good performance out of a floating point unit, because it took so many cycles to do a floating point operation. But that's no longer true. It only takes a few clock cycles to do a floating point operation, because we have more transistors. The current designer of a microprocessor has many more logic gates to use than Seymour Cray had when he designed the Cray. So these are just more sophisticated architectures. The other problem is that the Cray architecture, or the supercomputer architecture, really only worked when you were doing the same operation on each vector. You were doing A plus B. Now if you take a sort of more complex operation like, I don't know, doing text processing or something, you still have a lot of work you want to do, but these are not particularly long vectors. There might be a lot of characters to process, but they're not necessarily the same operation on each character. So you want a more flexible architecture, which is still pipeline, but you would like to do a different instruction at each clock cycle. So today's microprocessors are designed with a more flexible architecture to allow different operations on the, so you don't have these simple vectors with very regular identical operations which are characteristic of scientific computation. You have a more complex structure. So that's both allowed by the greater number of transistors and needed by applications, whether they be irregular. Even in science, when we come to look at these scientific algorithms, when we do Jacobi we can think of, we can do with these long vectors because Jacobi is very regular. But if I took an adaptive irregular mesh where all the data structures were linked lists, you will not be able to form these nifty vectors very easily. It will take a lot, it will not be natural. So even today's scientific algorithms don't particularly perform well on vector pipelines. And certainly text processing and stuff like that doesn't. However, the Cray is actually a very good computer getting good performance. And the reason is that Cray did get, while design, Cray is a very sophisticated design, a very mature design, and they did get the memory architecture very well. They have a very good design to actually fetch, to allow you to fetch lots of data from memory, to supply operands from around memory to the CPU at one or two operands per clock cycle. So the architecture of the memory system, which will have lots of different banks, each of which can be accessed simultaneously, that architecture is far cleverer than that on most workstations. And so actually a Cray will outperform and do extremely well compared to many parallel machines, even though the raw CPU looks better on a parallel on a node, just because they have a better memory architecture. Okay. So this foil actually comes from another foil set, A42, and this just illustrates a very simple machine pipeline with, in principle, here's each of these boxes is one clock cycle, and so here we have a pipeline we have here case, I guess, at least for registers, the register operations, five cycles per operation, but we can still get one result every clock cycle, but we are allowed a different instruction to start each clock cycle. So that's the end of the of this not terribly deep review of conventional machines. But I must admit, probably not many people in the community know who Flynn is, and he it's sort of interesting how you can. He probably wouldn't consider this his greatest contribution, but his work lives on in almost every paper on parallel computing because of this classification that he gave of computers into four architectures, where essentially he noted the computers consisted of CPUs which interpreted instructions and then did work on data. And so when you were looking at parallelism, you can either have parallelism at the instruction level, or parallelism at the data level. So as we have a binary choice at each of two issues, memory or CPU, we get four categories. We have the classical sequential computer, which is single instruction, single data. So I think, to be fair, we have to interpret the word single as a few, because certainly a modern microprocessor can do actually has multiple functional units and can do several operations per clock cycle. But it can't, it doesn't have any scaling to that, so it can just do a few. So I think you should replace S by F in this classification for a few. And you can certainly have, I say, multiple banks, which are essentially a few data streams. All right, so this is the classical von Neumann architecture where everything is single. So now we can, the first thing we can do is keep a single data source and have a bunch of instructions munching on it. Well, in some sense, that is quite, I mean, well, actually, you rarely have that, because even if you have a shared memory computer with, say, like in Java, where multiple threads running, those threads are each effectively have a separate data stream going into them. So you rarely have a single stream of data and multiple functions running in parallel. There are not many applications that fit that particular model. So that basically is a dead category. So as far as I know, there are no serious entries here. The next category, which was the earliest parallel machines, such as the ILIAC machine, those are single instruction, multiple data. So now you have lots of sources of data. Each stream of data has the same operation applied to it. So people usually consider vector supercomputers as having a SIMD floating point unit. Because a classical vector unit is doing the same operation, namely vector arithmetic, on several different data streams as they stream in a pipeline through the floating point unit. This is not a scaling parallelism, because you only get a parallelism effectively equal to the number of stages in your floating point unit. It certainly is a form of parallelism. But there are several SIMD machines, such as the mass bar downstairs and some of the first few machines from Thinking Machines. And the dominant parallel computer is multiple instructions and multiple data. And although it's not, I guess, implied by the name, in any implementation there's roughly a one-to-one match between the instruction streams and the data streams. So that the MIMD machine is just built out of separate SISD computers where And so you multiply the instruction stream because each node has a separate instruction stream, and you multiply the data stream because each node accesses its own data. So that's why they're MIMD. This classification makes it rather clear why SIMD might have a problem. The reason why SIMD has a problem is sort of trivially a special case of MIMD. Namely, I can always, if I have a program running on a SIMD machine, at least in principle, I can always run it on a MIMD machine by just replicating the instruction stream. So MIMDI machines can always run SIMD algorithms. And although that sounds a trivial remark, it is the central reason why SIMD machines aren't popular any longer. It's because when we started this, the amount of hardware necessary to implement the multiple instruction capability was a lot. And so a SIMD machine, which economized by having a single broadcast instruction stream, was able to produce, if you like, a more cost-effective solution than these complex MIMD machines with separate instruction streams associated with each data bank, memory bank. That is no longer true. Today, with except for very special examples, you can, SIMD machines have no significant cost advantage. I've already remarked on most computers, the cost of the CPU is a negligible component of the computer. It's a 5-10% type cost if you measure it in terms of silicon or stuff like that. So that's the fundamental. So anyway, so this classification covers the so-called synchronization or control structure. Now there's another dimension to parallel machines. Which is essentially, if you like, the memory access structure. And there are several possible structures. The two most important are shared memory and distributed memory. Shared memory can be accessed or can be implemented either where each processor can access any element of the data. It can also be implemented, as in the Kendall Square machine, as essentially a giant cache. I mean, there's a class of parallel machine. I mean, if you think about an ordinary computer, you think about, when you sort of write your program, you expect the Fortran or C++ compiler to stick your data point in a memory location, which is sort of with a definite address. Now, what a cache machine doesn't think of like that. It just says, all right, it creates this data. This data floats around in the memory of the machine. Hopefully, it migrates to the processor that really needs it, because remember, I said I needed data locality. And so in cache machines, there's one level of indirection. Data is not associated with a fixed location, and there's meant to be some clever hardware that controls all of that. Kendall Square, which had the first all-cache machine, is no longer in business, and so certainly it's fair to say that architecture is unproven, although I think many people would view it as rather interesting. So the two basic successful architectures are very simple. You have a shared memory where everybody can access any memory. You can just say, go and get memory location N, where N is a bit address, an address of the of that piece of data. And you, for shared memory, you can do that for all data points. On a distributed memory, you can do that for the memory on the node that's running the instruction. That will have its own memory. If you wish to go and get a data point for another node, you must send a message. So the obvious analogy with society is a shared memory is a bunch of people in a room which can always talk to each other if they talk loud enough. They could actually have contention if they all talk at the same time, but everybody can talk to each other. If we all sit in villages and the phone system's broken, the only way we can talk to each other is we can talk to people that are on our own village, but we have to send a letter, which is a message to anybody in a different village. So we can always talk to each other. In the distributed memory architecture, there's one level of indirection in the communication. You change technologies from a direct access to a message. Alright, so all this foil says is that it basically makes the point that at some level there is really no difference between distributed memory and shared memory. What a shared memory system can do is this processor can just write the address of that memory location, and the hardware fetches it here. For a distributed memory, this processor must test that if memory here, go and get it from here with an ordinary hardware memory access. If memory on another processor, send a message and then grab the data off that processor. So they are logically at some level the same. However, there is a different cost function associated with this. This has a huge cost function associated with it. So you could say distributed memory machines are going to be slower than shared memory. Actually, probably the opposite is true, because effectively a shared memory has this hardware structure. Because if you have memory sitting on different processors with on different PC boards or in different locations, it will take longer to get it. What the shared memory architecture does is hide that from the software. It makes that a hardware function. And so you can argue that the distributed memory system is actually more efficient because it forces the user to realize which memory accesses are the most expensive, and to A, to minimize them, and B, to make steps to make them more efficient, which in making them more efficient is gathering all the memory accesses on this processor together, putting them all in a message. So instead of sending 15 tiny messages, each asking for one word, we send one message asking for 15 words. And the problem with the shared memory architecture, apart from the cache, which may or may not be easy to build for such a system, there's very hard for the hardware to do that type of blocking and to get a great deal of efficiency. So the huge advantage of shared memory is it's much easier to build the software because you have a single hardware mechanism, access memory, which is the same hardware mechanism that you have on a conventional SISD machine, von Neumann machine. So shared memory machines are much easier to port existing sequential code. And so their great success has been that the porting problem has been far easier. And although the performance is probably not as good as this design, the absolute or the in principle performance, the realized performance, with real users who only have a limited time to modify their code, has probably been higher on shared memory than distributed memory systems. The goal, of course, of compilers and projects such as high-performance C++, Java, and Fortran is to try to hide this difference from the user. So the user uses a shared memory programming model. So as far as the user is concerned, they write the code like that, and the compiler ingeniously takes this type of architecture, bundles all the messages up, all the memory accesses up into big messages, and implements it using wonderful optimized runtime to make the system efficient, make the shared memory programming model efficient. The problem is that, as we found out, it's quite hard to build these compilers. Further, there is no way to build a compiler to do that for existing C++, Fortran, or Java. You have to modify the language to essentially give hints to the compiler as to how to do this optimization. And that's because these sequential languages, such as Java, Fortran, and C++, have thrown away the information needed by the compiler to do this optimization. And it has to be added back in. The trouble is when you add it back in, you get a different language which requires the code to be modified, and that, of course, imposes user resistance. The resistance is particularly great if, even when they've done the hard work of converting the code, the compiler doesn't work. And at least until recently, the problem has been the compiler hasn't worked. So there are, at least in principle, many types of memory architectures. So here we're effectively discussing shared memory machines, and there are, in the formal classification, two types of memory access times. The thing you'd like to have is uniform memory access, which is that every memory location takes the same time to access. So that's called UMA, or uniform. Now, the only machine that is currently available which has that property, which is large. I mean, if you go to a shared memory system from Sun where you have a bus, you effectively have uniform memory access. The problem is you can only put a modest number of machines on the bus, so it doesn't scale. So there is a clever machine from Burton Smith, who is in Seattle with a company called Terra, which has uniform memory access. However, it is unproven because the cost he's had to pay to get uniform memory access is to violate all the rules, because he's had to build his own memory structure, his own processors, and his own compilers. So it violates this principle of using consumer technology. And so, although he has a system which is scalable and has uniform memory access, whether it's competitively priced is not so obvious, and he's just, I think, delivering his first system to the San Diego supercomputer at this moment. And so there's a lot of interest in those machines because they are quite elegant. But whether they're practical and work and really deliver on their promises is unproven. So apart from that, essentially every system, shared memory system, is non-uniform memory access. And the reason it's non-uniform memory access is just life. Namely, that's natural. Because when you put memory, if you have a lot of memory, which is physically in different places and with different memory controllers, the only way that one processor can talk to a memory that's, inverted commas, far away is by going through additional hardware and additional distance. And remember, the speed of light is whatever it is, a nanosecond a foot. So that says that it takes several nanoseconds to cross even a modest-sized parallel computer. And so as clock speeds are themselves just a few nanoseconds these days, that says that it takes the physical reasons why memory, just the speed of light or the speed of electrons, which is less than the speed of light, ensures that you cannot, that memory far away must take longer than memory that's near to you. But more importantly, it's just the overhead. You're going to have hardware, switches, and controllers, and bus arbitrators, and you have got to go from off-chip, you've got to go from chip to off-chip, back to chip again, and all these things cost time and hardware. And so you will always find that any natural design has non-uniform memory access. The only reason Burton Smith can get uniform memory access is by effectively slowing everybody down, but then have a clever strategy involving multiple threads so that everybody actually looks as though they're running fast, but actually he's slowing everybody down so that they all go at the slowest speed. Any natural design is bound to have non-uniform memory access. And as you go to these amusing computers built from systems around the world, it's going to get worse and worse, because then you're certainly going to have effects from the speed of light. And you're going to have even more effects and more control if you have to go through FDDI or ATM switches. I mean, those all add overhead, which is memory access time. Now, if you take a carefully designed parallel computer like the SP2 or the Cray T3D, there are really only two memory access times. There's the local memory access the memory on your machine, and then there's access the memory from any other computer. There is really no difference between if you have a 128-node SP2 and you sit on one processor, the memory on the other 127 looks as though it has the same access time. As you go to higher performance systems, as we go towards petaflop performance 10 years from now, that will not be true. Because of the physical dimension problems and stuff like that, you will have lots of memory access times. You'll start seeing the physical structure of the computer. But today, where you only have, like on the SP2, the clock speeds are sort of 100 nanosecond type range. So 100 megahertz. Effectively, each processor looks the same. And the switching technology that people use makes all processors look the same, unless they're the local processor. So essentially, a NUMA machine has two memory access times, on processor or off processor. That was when we were doing the Hypercube 15 years ago, that was different, because we were using whatever is store and forward messaging. So as the letter, I mean, it's sort of like U.S. Postal Service, at least in sort of 1,000 miles from here, you have one-day deliveries wherever you are. If you like, in Syracuse, you have a two-memory access time, roughly. Time in Syracuse is sort of 30 minutes or less, because you can always drive anywhere in 30 minutes. And then if you need a letter to anybody else, that's one day, so two times. So that's like today's parallel machines. In the old hypercubes, the way we had to send messages from one node to another was by passing it through intermediate routing chips, and the total transit time was equal to the number of routing chips that went through, and so there was a distance which was actually equal to the distance in the hypercube, which was the transit time. So the memory access time was linear in the transit time through the network. So early networks had that property, that the access time was dependent on the network topology. But today's networks do not have that structure. They use wormhole routing and circuit switch technology, which gives essentially uniform access time for everybody outside the current processor. So probably I should have shown this already. This is this so this sort of trivially shows the two types of memory access structures. Shared memory has a bunch of processors which in the simplest design do not have their own memory, but they could do, and then you will get a NUMA system with its local memory and its global memory. You have some sort of network which could be a bus, and you access a bunch of memories. In the simplest distributed memory machine, we have a network, which in the most extreme case is the World Wide Web, and then we have a bunch of processors, each with their own memory. So that was sort of a discussion of memory structure. Our next thing to discuss is actually Flynn's classification, which is the synchronization structure or the control structure. So we've already pointed out that in SIMD the synchronization is very simple. Every processor executes the same instruction stream, and so in some sense that's an advantage of SIMD, because there is no overhead from synchronization, because everything is automatically synchronized. Now that's also of course a negative of SIMD, because if you don't want them synchronized, you may have to waste what they do on something, but there is no synchronization overhead. MIMD, originally, one of the reasons people were worried about MIMD, this was a long time ago, 20 years ago, was that the synchronization overhead was, they thought it would be high, but that turned out not to be true. And there are various strategies for synchronizing. If you have a shared memory model, you can see the synchronization. It's probably the neatest way is just to look at Java, which has the thread model of Java has locks built in, which are a synchronization model. So you just study that language, you can see it, how to do that synchronization. Some shared memory systems have special hardware, in fact most of them do, to produce effectively coherent caches, and that's all that's essentially their way of doing synchronization. In the case of the types of distributed memory systems, the synchronization is automatic from message passing. And if you go back to that Laplace example we went through, I mean, although we didn't discuss it, but if you look at those examples, I never discussed synchronization. I said we take these 16 data points, we put them in each processor, they send messages to each other. I didn't say we ever had to synchronize them, and the answer is, the reason was we never did. There was no synchronization necessary, because the synchronization was implied by one processor sending a message and the other processor receiving it. So that the actual act of sending a message and receiving synchronizes operations. So that's also true with a bricklayer. When one bricklayer speaks about how they coordinate their work at the boundary between the walls they're building, and the second bricklayer responds, that synchronizes them. So if you think about that example, suppose we have a very slothful bricklayer who is very slow. So what happens? Well, nothing really happens, at least in this model I had. The fast bricklayer blazes the bricks, and then he sort of shouts at his neighbor, what are you going to do? We're trying to join up our bricks where we should. And so he keeps screaming at the bricklayer who's very slow, and eventually the bricklayer is very slow, reaches the end, and then answers his call. So what happens is the fast bricklayer waits for the slow bricklayer. So the same is true in parallel computers. One computer sends a message. If the other computer is busy and doing something else, the message waits. When the computer that's meant to receive the message gets round to it, it answers the message, and that act of waiting for a message synchronizes the systems. And so that's actually another very important feature about all of parallel computing, is that there is no need for global synchronization. If we're building my wall, I do not have to have a foreman telling each bricklayer when they're meant to reach the middle and join their sections together. They just have to do it themselves, and the very fact that they do it themselves in a binary fashion is all that has to happen, because the local consistency guarantees global synchronization. And that's, again, the same is true in parallel computing. There is no global synchronization necessary, and so there is no global overhead, which is why you get scaling parallels. So there's no overheads which are significant for synchronization. So that's an important property, which I don't think, although it's now, I think, generally appreciated. Essentially, all parallel computers are like that. And in fact, nature's like that. a piece of grass in the Syracuse University lawn does not have to wait for a piece of grass in another part of the world to ask permission to grow. It just grows. And then the fact that this grass grows and sends out carbon dioxide in the air or absorbs or whatever it does, eventually they communicate with each other doing the things they do by sending chemical messages, but they don't have to have any global synchronization. So you're right. And they also recognize summer independently and when it's a good time to grow. So they do their own thing. And synchronization is guaranteed by sort of the natural local interaction. So the same, that's true in nature and it's true in parallel computing. So as I mentioned, we're actually in a pretty interesting time as far as computer architecture is concerned. I mean, if you look actually downstairs where we have rather archaic machines apart from our shared memory SGI system, the SP2 in some sense is an architecture that probably won't be built for a while again because it's a closely coupled distributed memory system without any special hardware for shared memory. So that represents in some sense an architecture of the past, because I believe all future machines of that type, including the next generation of machines from IBM, will have some form of hardware assist for shared memory. It will be different vendors, and it's not quite clear what's a good idea. Convex will do one thing, and Cray SGI another, and IBM yet a third thing, that's the leading vendors. But they all are committed to a shared memory architecture, but it's all this so-called distributed shared memory, which is a shared memory hardware built in the NUMA fashion, non-uniform memory fashion, out of distributed memory components. So you take the basic architecture, which is nodes with their own memory, but you just have hardware-assisted access so that you can access the memory of remote processors directly. And I told you why that has to happen. That's because users have voted with their pocketbooks, and they buy such machines preferentially because they're easier to run. However, why it's sort of so if you listen to Ken Kennedy, his compiler group will be focusing in I think the next three to five years on how to build compilers for this so-called distributed shared memory system. It's viewed as the most important challenge. So this is the classic MIMDI distributed memory architecture, which we've already shown, a bunch of processors. They have their own memory. There's some communication network. And of course, I said that architecture is going out of fashion, except it isn't really. Because just at the same time that closely coupled machines are becoming shared memory, the most interesting machines, period, I think most people would view as clusters of computers. So I just noticed that Todd Olson announced that our cluster of 8 Sun Ultra Spark 2 systems is available and operational. So that, MPAC chose to get us its next systems, clusters of Suns, shared memory SGI, and it will get a cluster of Windows NT PCs. So I guess we believe that the most interesting machines of the future, although there's going to be some role for central shared memory systems for really compute intense problems that need that close coupling, the most interesting machines will be networks of workstations or networks of personal computers, which networks will become equivalent because workstations and personal computers are more or less the same thing. And so it's sort of ironic that that's just as the SP2 becomes itself an uninteresting architecture as a closely coupled share of distributed memory machine, it is actually the best model of the most important architecture, which is what I call the informal supercomputer, a cluster of system machines. So we see these two contradictory trends. So it's actually quite nice. It means that we can take everything we learned from distributed memory machines like the SP2, compiler technology, algorithms, but now apply it to networks of systems. And then we need to enhance that knowledge to apply to distributed shared memory to see where the special performance of high performance functionality of distributed shared memory machines can be automatically exploited to get improved performance on such systems. So the net result of this, in some sense, is that none of our work is wasted. Everything we learned, but they're just going to be targeted at different types of machines. The distributed memory work is going to be targeted at the more heterogeneous systems. The shared memory system is going to actually have to be extended to cope with the extended memory hierarchies you'll see on these distributed memory systems. So in each case, we have more challenges because the network of workstations will have high latencies and sort of heterogeneous and complicated. So we're going to have to go from elegant, simple things like the SP2 to a more complicated, heterogeneous environment with that technology. I see none of the work that's actually being done up to now, in some sense, as being phased out. It's just being redirected as these architectures are changing. And actually, it's sort of, nobody really knows how people will vote. There is a chance that clusters of workstations will basically supersede these tightly coupled machines, which are these shared memory systems. And that they will, the shared memory large systems from IBM and SGI and Convex may not be proved popular because it will turn out that most applications can be run on clusters of workstations. Because networking technology is getting so much better that these clusters of workstations have very good performance. So that is, I think, unknown. And it's controversial. Nobody really knows how good a performance you can actually get from either of these architectures. We do not know how optimizing compiler technology really works on distributed memory shared systems, nor do we really know how it works on clusters of workstations, because both of these are extensions. So I see these as very important questions which can only be understood by doing a bunch of applications and trying to do better than we did with HPF, namely trying to produce compiler technology that's ready when the user wants it, not 5 years after the user wants it, which is what happened with sort of the previous generation of technology. Well, I pointed out that there's been this trend away from topology as being interesting. You know, it used to be when we first invented the hypercube, people used to wax and write lots of articles about nifty new topologies which had slightly better distance issues. But it turned out it never was important because even on the hypercube, especially the initial commercial one, the performance was always dominated by latency, which was startup time, which was the sending the message and receiving it. It was never dominated by the transit time. So most of that work, although it was mathematically well-defined, and even intellectually well-defined, when you fed in the realities of software, it was unimportant. And the current trend is the same, that at least for a system sitting in a geographically reasonably close location like, say, MPAC, I don't think network topologies matter too much. Well, of course, it matters if eight machines have an OC3 ATM and then there's a single Ethernet link to another eight machines. That topology matters because there's a huge bandwidth issue on the Ethernet compared to the ATM. But I don't think it matters too much if they go through routers, as long as those routers and switches aren't too much of an overhead, because that's up to now, all topology issues have proven to be unimportant because of the dominance, because the network transmission time is not what's the problem. Now, if you have a machine here and a machine in San Diego, then you'll see the transmission time, and so you have that will then be a topology issue. So the worldwide computer is a topology issue, but it's going to be very difficult to do any, say, closely coupled computation like, say, fluid dynamics on machines which are separated that far apart, because when you look at those algorithms, you need close coupling. They need to be reasonably close to each other to avoid excessive overheads in the message transmission time. You can only really use worldwide separated machine to do applications which have intrinsically loose coupling between components, and so you can afford high latency. Or you need some nifty thread algorithm to hide the latency. But so I would say what really counts is what is the real performance of the network, and what is the, especially the latency, because it's the old hardware delivered up to now was always performed much more poorly than the advertised performance. You know, Mary Pagani was in raptures when ATM delivers 20 megabits per second out of a total of 150, because at some stages it's down to less than a megabit per second. You know, I mean, these switches can have incredible overheads with today's protocol mismatches and whatever goes on and causes these terrible issues. So until we get to a world where we're dominated by transmission time, network topology turns out to be relatively unimportant. But it is extremely important to address, you know, I mean, to package up your messages, reduce the number of messages, and minimize the bandwidth needed, because these network of workstations tend to have higher latency and lower bandwidth than the dedicated machine. So to be competitive, you have to be very careful about these methodologies to minimize latency and bandwidth, which is really a node issue, not a network topology issue, typically. Although you can always design a you can design a terrible topology for which it would be important, but for typical topologies, it's not important. Okay, thank you. I say, if anybody still hasn't handed in homework one, either why don't you email me, because then I don't have to keep going to the website to see if it's there, or just give it to me. And the two I haven't emailed with my comments on their homework, I'll do that now. The others, everybody else should have got there. So if you haven't had email from me tomorrow, complain, because it means I've lost your homework. Thank you.